Is it time to mandate the wearing of masks across the country?
Oh, I definitely long overdue for that. And my understanding that the Centers for Disease Control has recommended the use of masks, but not required it, because they don't want to offend the president. The president should be example. Real men wear masks. Be an example to the country and wear the mask. It's not about protecting yourself. It's about protecting others.
That was Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi arguing this weekend that due to the rapidly rising number of coronavirus cases, the federal government should impose a nationwide mask mandate requiring every person in America to dress like a superhero or supervillain. Good morning and happy Monday. I am Peter Suderman, filling in for Matt Welch, and this is the Reason Roundtable. I am joined today by my regular co-panelists, Nick Gillespie and Catherine Mangy Ward, as well as special guest, Robbie Suave. Everyone say hello.
Howdy.
Hey.
Hi.
Hi, everyone. Last week, I said that although we might
now
be
tell
done...
us to wear a mask, please.
guys, we're going to get to that. We are going to get to the mandatory mask part of this conversation, but we're not there yet. Because first, we have to talk about how even though we might be done with the coronavirus still isn't done with us. I said that last week. Unfortunately, it turned out to be more true than even I expected. Case numbers surged nationally last week with 45,255 new cases on Friday alone, a record that beat the previously recorded highs in April when daily new case numbers hovered around 30,000. Those surging case numbers were driven heavily by outbreaks in Florida, which alone saw more than 9,500 new confirmed cases on Saturday, and Texas, which also reported daily records throughout the week with more than 5,000 new cases per day. This is like the weather at this point. We're now just like, oh, there's new records all the time. The scene in both states was pretty much what you'd expect. In Florida, the mayor of Pinecrest Village urged residents to stop having house parties, calling them, quote, the most dangerous things that impact our community. And in Texas, Governor Abbott's order also shut down all tubing and rafting. No cabrewing for you. Both states had been among the first to reopen their economies, and both have now rolled back their reopening plans, closing bars to on-site alcohol sales and halting plans to continue reopening. Truly, this is a bummer for Florida men everywhere. But it is not just big southern states where case numbers are going up. The coronavirus is also making a comeback in states like Ohio and in California, where Governor Gavin Newsom ordered bars to close again in Los Angeles, as well as half a dozen other counties. Catherine, I want to start with you. As our level-headed anarchist, 1 month ago or so, Vice President Mike Pence was congratulating. Yeah, you're level-headed.
No, I'm
and
saying
an anarchist.
That's like it's a surrealist image. It's a soluble fish by Andrew Breton. Level-headed anarchist.
Go ahead, Peter.
All right, so let's get back to another surrealist image. Mike Pence congratulating his own administration, just anything to do with Mike Pence, but in particular, Pence congratulating his own administration for having, quote, stabilized new cases around 20,000 per day. Now, granted, that was, in fact, actually down quite a bit from April. Earlier this month, Trump said that even without a vaccine, the virus is, quote, going to fade away. Some people were praising Florida's Republican governor, Ron DeSantis, for having managed to keep the virus in check while reopening. Not so much now. So, Catherine, what are we supposed to make of this? Has reopening been a failure?
Yes, but not just for the reasons that you listed. So, basically, this is...
That's right. Attack the moderator.
Yeah. Basically, question the premise of the question when it's a hard question is a good strategy always in life, kids. So, take it from your local level-headed anarchist. So, basically, here's the thing. You know, there was a lot of talk early on about whether reopening was the right step, whether it was appropriate. A lot of the decision to reopen, I think, in these states, and not just red states, Republican governor states, but all across the country, reopening decisions were driven almost entirely by the sense of the psychology of the population. And I think that that is where any attempts at reclosing are going to stumble. Every time the government does this, every time the government says, now here is a big new set of rules, whether they are more open or more closed, people are less likely to listen to those rules. We are approaching a convergence where the government will issue a bunch of statements about who can or can't be open or do what where, and people will greet it with perfect equanimity. They will simply disregard whatever the state says and go about their business. Now, businesses are in a different position than individuals. Individuals can say, I'm going to wear my mask or not wear my mask, and unless you have enough police officers to come after me, you are, you know, you are SOL. Businesses are going to risk their licenses. And so the commercial reopening question, I think, is the more important one. And Peter, that's the one that you kind of focused on here. But
most of the rollbacks have been focused on businesses, bars in particular, which Governor Abbott in Texas said were responsible for at least some of the increase in spread.
But again, this gets us back to the place of it's really much more about the psychology of people and their willingness to obey. The focus on house parties and bars and recreational activities is, to my mind, largely theatrical and punitive. And so that's what I think we should talk about a little
bit. So you're saying we're not going to hear the same people say that protests should stay home? Protesters
right.
should
so
stay
like
home
it,
because
you know,
they're immune, right? Or something. Yeah.
Right. So obviously it's the end of June. There have been some Pride events. Of course, there were all of the BLM and associated protests earlier in this cycle. The sort of willingness to scapegoat specific activities, I think, is really worth closer scrutiny, and especially when it's the state saying these particular activities are the ones we think we can get away with banning, and that are something that we can kind of do that shows that we are taking action, and they may or may not be the right choices to genuinely stem the spread of the virus. It is simply not true that 10-person house parties are the most threatening vector in America. It's not.
You've never been to a South Florida house party, though, I take it.
I didn't think only like five people walk out, though, right?
Yeah.
Or that tubing is the most threatening activity, right?
Again, you've never tubed
Where's the association of tubing with outbreaks of coronavirus?
Come on, this goes back to the ancient Egyptians. Robbie, we all know that tubing, that's why they lost, that's why they lost the Israelites for too much tubing.
The curse of Ramses.
To follow up on what Catherine was saying, this is obviously a real tough issue. If cases are going up, and I'm less interested in cases than in deaths, because without necessarily going whole hog on what Trump was saying, even the case rate increasing is not as important to me ultimately as the death rate. And that's fundamentally what we need to be concerned about for the most part. But the larger point that Catherine is making about how the government is in all of these kind of reversals where they come up with a new thing that countermands what they just said, this is going too far out. However long the coronavirus sticks around for, that moment that kind of two-step is going to last much, much longer. And it is ultimately disastrous, I would argue, even for libertarians. Like when you have a government that has become, or authorities that have become so completely disbelieved, that is not a building block for, you know, a healthy society down the road. And I'm actually seriously worrying about that. At the same time that it seems to me that people, you know, for the most part, have internalized what they're going to do and why they're going to do it. And this is a time where it might be good if the CDC actually stepped forward and copped to its mistakes and then started rebuilding whatever kind of trust or confidence as a honest broker of information that it might be able to generate at this late date.
It's probably worth noting here that the median age of a new coronavirus patient in Florida is now 36 years old, which is much younger than it had been and gives you a sense of what demographic is catching the virus, at least right now. The worry is that deaths will eventually follow increased spread.
But the mortality rates are still basically where they were. And so if you're younger and if you're under 50, obviously everybody's at some level of risk, but it starts to approach zero very quickly.
Robbie, I want to talk about young people here for a minute. You are one. You know about them. One question that has vexed a lot of folks.
I don't know if we're going to be able to let that go, Peter.
Yeah,
hold
this
on.
Is, wow, this has been a real rearrangement of, you bring in a younger person, and then Peter is now talking like Tiresias.
I am the voice of authority. authority here.
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't think I get away with the token young person anymore, to
Robbie,
be honest, guys.
You were
guys.
Recently a young person. You are closer to being a young person than anyone else here. And therefore, you have intimate personal knowledge of what it is like to be one. Also, you write about education policy, and that's what I want to ask you about. One of the questions that has vexed a lot of people and frustrated a lot of parents, I think, is why are bars reopening but not schools? Even as bars have reopened to varying degrees across the country and in most places, as I understand it, they're at least somewhat open, despite some of the closures in big states. It looks a lot like schools are not going to fully reopen next fall. Robbie, you are a school reopener, but the thing about schools is they're mandatory indoor gathering places for hundreds or even thousands of people every single day, or at least several days a week in the current plans, mostly indoors. And yes, they have lots of kids, but they also have dozens or even hundreds of adult faculty and employees, all of whom will end up traveling to and from work, interacting, spreading around their droplets. And not just inside the school, but across their communities. So why should those schools come back online if big states right now can't even manage to keep bars open for a few weeks?
Well, first of all, as a libertarian, I don't think school should be mandatory. If you don't want your kids going back to school this fall, that's fine with me.
Reopen schools makes them non-mandatory.
As a taxpayer whose money has been taken to provide this public daycare, which so many people rely on so they can go back to work, I mean, this whole thing has been so backward, the reopening, because how can people go back to work if there's no one to take care of their kids per what usually happens in the fall? You're right that the measures aimed at kind of protecting people as we reopen the schools and if we reopen the schools, they should definitely be aimed at the adults working there. To some degree, it is actually easier to kind of protect the adults, at least from each other. You could have them wearing masks if they want. You could have people in high-risk groups. Sure, I think schools should make it possible for them to take the semester off or perhaps work in some remote learning. But a lot of the freak-out has been concentrated at the children themselves. So there's plans to have the children wear masks, to have them like have to sit 6 feet apart in the classroom, which is going to be just totally unworkable. I was reading about some plan to do temperature checks before you get on the bus. And then if you fail your temperature check, the bus just sits and waits for your parent to come get you. So you're going to have, so all the kids are going to just wait on the bus. So you have your entire school day sometimes on the bus.
What about their parents to get them to come from the bus stop. How does that
work?
Schools will do anything to shut down. And, you know, those of us who lived or live in the Northern Virginia, Montgomery County area around D.C. know this. If there is a prediction of snow 6 months in the future, the schools will shut down.
Right.
I mean, schools, they have a great bunch of cards to play, but let's face it. The American Academy of Pediatricians says schools should reopen because it's really important to kids. Kids are mostly safe. Sweden, which did not disrupt its kids' schooling, didn't have massive outbreaks among kids or the parents of kids. What Robbie's talking about, there are various ways to deal with this, but the onus should be on schools to say close. The presumption should be that they should be opening up and trying to get back to normal. Colleges are doing it. We'll see how it plays out. But are we just going to this goes to that the large question that was being asked months ago. Are we trying to flatten the curve or are we trying to make it so nobody ever gets infected again? Because right now we're living in a world where we're coming back to this idea that if anybody new gets infected, then we got to shut everything down again. And that didn't work the first time. And it's going to destroy the economy even more, which then leads to other problems.
Especially when we're talking about kids here, where the risk is like really based on the scientific evidence we have, it's like approaching zero for K through 12. So it does not seem in keeping with the science of this thing to say that, oh my God, it would be unthinkable to open the schools. How dare you put it's like a think of the children thing that is just so unscientific and really. It really bothers me.
I will say I was talking to a Republican policy advisor in a state that was looking to reopen the schools. And they said, look, our problem is not the students. We're not worried about the students nearly as much as we are worried about, to some extent, the faculty, but really the older workers. And it is, and not the, so this isn't teachers. This is bus drivers, cafeteria staff, janitors, you know, folks working to some extent in the kind of administration. And they said there's just a lot of people who are at very high risk there because they are older. In many cases, they are minorities. And they said, we would like to reopen. We can't figure out how to protect those people without basically keeping them out of the school. And then you, the schools don't function without those workers. And so
there's, you know, 20%.
I think that the point about the kids is totally right. But it is a logistical issue, even for states that are looking to try to find ways to reopen these schools, how to kind of separate the at-risk populations from the much less at-risk populations.
Yeah,
so
it's a challenge.
The other thing that's going
it's
on
a challenge.
Here.
It's not like an unsolvable riddle or something like that. And again, I mean, you know, what the hell are teachers' unions for? You know, other than not delivering for anybody, whether it's students or their own teachers, but let them figure out how to, you know, save their most protected people. Or do they have a trust fund? Do they have a war chest for this? Like, you know, pay people not to work or to do stuff via Zoom. You know, and I mean, I'm sorry, like the, and I'm not saying anybody on the show is saying this, but it's like, you know, the idea that if one person in a particular situation could get hurt, and especially if they're old and a minority and this and that, like then we just can't go any further in the conversation. It's like, yeah, it's a logistical nightmare. There's no question about it. And I've been talking to college. I just talked to two people who work at a college where their college is predicting a $50 million hit over the coming year. And that's with it reopening because of a variety of problems. Like, yeah, it's really a shit deal, but we got to deal with it, you know, because the alternative is to do what? I mean, it's
to do nothing forever.
Yeah. The alternative is to do nothing forever. I have been very interested as someone who has young kids who are kind of in the middle of this conversation. I've been very, very interested in the way that the conversation is playing out with respect to public schools and private schools, because the incentives there are so radically different. And I know that Robbie started his answer with, like, in conclusion, legalize heroin. But, you know, it is true that the built-in nature of a large mandatory public schooling apparatus is creating bad incentives right now, because schools get their money. Public schools get their money no matter what. Public school funding is not tied in most places to children actually getting a successful education or even necessarily getting an education at all. They are sometimes tied to number of days open, but states will simply make exceptions to that. This time around, you can feel very confident, or they will count, you know, some kind of half-assed virtual learning as a day open. Private schools, both colleges and K-12, are facing death. They are going to have to shut down. Most private schools, again, both colleges and K-12, depend on tuition money to function. That is the nature of their business. And parents are not going to pay tuition money to a school that is only partially open or not open at all. That means that they are highly incentivized to figure out solutions. And when I am talking to my friends whose children are in private schools, I am hearing a lot of talk about creative solutions. Now, maybe none of those will be possible, because maybe those creative solutions will themselves be rendered illegal. That is a distinct possibility here. But, you know, I'm hearing about, well, maybe we rent an additional building and we isolate cohorts of students. Maybe we do a situation where we generate only one-on-one learning and essentially switch over to like a tutor system. Public schools aren't doing any of these things. They have no incentives to do these things. If creative solutions are happening, they are happening at the teacher-student level, and they are not being scaled because there's no mechanism to scale them. And teachers' unions, far from being helpful in this, are going to be the most powerful force for staying closed, because they represent not the interests of the children, as we have discussed many times on this podcast, but the interests of the teachers. And the teachers are in more danger. The teachers genuinely do need someone to represent their interests here. So I'm not saying no, you know, groups of workers advocating for their rights. I'm not actually totally anti-union, despite what you might hear on this podcast. But I do think teachers' unions are not going to be a helpful force here in moving toward a reasonable accommodation to get schools open.
You guys have raised the question about what we can do here and what we should do and what we have to do. And I think you have all overlooked one possibility, which is that we can find someone to blame. And that's a bunch of what we have done, right? Yeah. The argument about reopening. Yeah, right. Is we found a scapegoat. And the argument about reopening has devolved totally predictably into an argument about partisan politics in which big southern red states with GOP governors are being accused of prioritizing their economies at the expense of the health of their citizens. The headline to a New York Times columnist, Paul Krugman's most recent column was, "America didn't give up on COVID-19, Republicans did." So, Nick, I want to go to you. Yeah. God. Are Republicans blowing it? Is this mostly a story of how one party, Democrats, got it right, and one party, Republicans, got it wrong? You live in the great state of New York, governed by a Cuomo. I'm going to guess you disagree.
Yeah, I mean, this is, Paul Krugman, it's almost 10 years ago in a column in a blog post. He talked about how he doesn't bother to read people who disagree with him anymore because he can learn nothing from them. And, you know, that was kind of the bat signal.
Pretty clear that he has learned nothing from them.
Yeah. But it was also kind of, a nice tell that, like, maybe we should stop paying attention to him. I live in New York State, where Andrew Cuomo managed one of the most tremendous, PR feats in recent history, by being considered like a good governor over, while presiding over the worst outbreak and situation of COVID-19 in the country, arguably in the world for a particular jurisdiction that size. Bill de Blasio, the Democratic mayor, even more feckless than Cuomo. This is not about Republican and Democratic. I'm in California right now. Gavin Newsom has gotten praise for locking the state down early. He's relocking down, as you mentioned, Peter, certain aspects of it. Yeah, it follows up from what Catherine was talking about, how the government is doing everything possible to make it impossible to believe that we are not in a simulation of late Brezhnev Soviet Union media or something like that. And then, the politics and media people are just making it even more difficult to have meaningful conversations about anything. And I think Krugman is the exemplar of that. He's the saint. He's the Buddha of bullshit at this point.
It also, though, happened so casually in so many other places. I actually pulled a piece that was in the Washington Post, I think on Saturday, because it was just like a bog standard normal article in the Washington Post. And the headline was, "With few rules in place, airlines, airports adopt their own strategies for combating the coronavirus." And it's just exactly what you expect, which is an exploration of the Washington Post's underlying idea, and this is, it's a news piece, that there should be federal standards and that federal standards are the only way to have high and effective standards. And there are all these quotes in this piece from people saying, Representative from, I think, Oregon, DeFazio, saying, "It's not right and it's not responsible. This administration wants to stick its head in the sand and say it's not our responsibility." And this is with respect to giving specific across-the-board guidance mandates to the airline industry about how they protect their clients. And, it's such a truism. It's such a sort of cliche for a person who thinks that markets are generally good to point this out, but airlines really, really don't want people to die of coronavirus from flying. They have just a huge incentive.
Crazy talk. The next thing you'll be saying that restaurants don't want to kill their customers. Catherine, come on.
I know.
It's the 21st century.
Bananas. And the idea that like different airlines and airports might be trying different things to keep their customers alive, the idea that that is a sign of a massive failure in our country is just, it's not even questioned in this article. It's not even questioned by most people. And I really don't know how to get through that. I mean, if the only way that you can be convinced that people are taking an issue seriously is if there is a mandate at the federal level to behave in a certain way, we are screwed as a country because we need experimentation. We need people to try different things because we don't know what works. We still don't know what works.
Well, and also all the people, usually the people calling most forcefully for more federal mandates or saying there should be more federal mandates tend to also think the person in charge of making federal mandates is a version of Hitler. So it's always very interesting that it's that meme of the guy pressing the button, like call for more federal mandates. Also, guy making federal mandates is dystopian.
Wipe sweat off forehead. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you guys have also, you've forgotten one of the things that you could blame here. And I just want to talk about this real quick before we move on, which is if you are a Democrat, you can blame Republicans. If you are a Republican, you can blame testing. And that's what a bunch of Republicans have done. Right. You have President Trump has talked on several occasions about how greater testing makes America look bad because more tests give you positive results. Just last week, Mike Pence, the vice president, said at a press conference, to one extent or another, the volume of new cases coming in is a reflection of a great success in expanding testing across the country. But if you look at the positivity rates, and we've already mentioned this a little bit, you're seeing a big bump in positivity rates in Florida, Texas, Arizona, as well as increased hospitalization. So just to explain that a little bit, in Florida a month ago, the positivity rate was about 3%, meaning that for every 100 people who were tested, 3 had the virus. Now, and this is according to the state's Republican governor, now that number is about 15%. And so we've got, you know, one party saying it's the Republicans' fault, and the other party saying, actually, it's just testing and sort of ignoring the math on this. So I think is a pretty good setup for the next topic, which is the election, which is coming, right? And which is going to be a contest between Democrats saying everything is Republicans' fault and Republicans saying, wait, look, a blimp, there's testing. In less than 5 months, we're going to have yet another presidential election. And from the looks of it, Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee, stands a good chance of winning in a landslide, at least if we held the election today. A New York Times Siena College poll last week found Biden with a whopping 14-point lead over Trump. Other polls seem to confirm Biden's big lead. Biden appears to be gaining on Trump in virtually every critical demographic. He's also leading Trump in several key states, such as Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, where the former vice president has a double-digit lead in each state. The numbers have gotten bad enough that Fox News personality Charles Gasparino last night tweeted that Trump was actually thinking about dropping out. That's probably fanciful. But more realistically and perhaps more meaningfully, which may be a sad commentary on where we're at, Robert Costa of the Washington Post reported that Trump was rethinking Biden's nickname. So instead of Sleepy Joe, he's thinking about Swampy Joe or Creepy Joe or Corrupt Joe, because Sleepy just doesn't sound threatening enough. Nick, the rap on Joe Biden right now is that he's hiding in a basement, that he's barely done any campaigning, that he's barely released any plans or delivered any major speeches. And that's kind of true. He's just hanging out at home like the rest of us, and he's winning. So why is Biden doing
brilliant.
So well?
He's been brilliant because when you aggregate the polls, the last one I saw, Trump was at about 41%, Biden was at like 50.1%. So I think it's tighter than the Siena poll, but there is no question every day that Joe Biden keeps his mouth shut, he goes up in the polls. And this is going to be, at what point, you know, will it be in July? Will it be in August? Will it be in September when he cannot keep his mouth shut? And he's because when
he
appears and he talks for more than 20 seconds, you know, everything goes haywire. It's like somebody's pouring Coca-Cola over his CPU and he starts talking about how, like, make sure that you marry a woman with 5 sisters because at least one of them is going to love you. And, you know, corn pop and pomade and Esther Williams. I just watched
just
an episode of Rick and Morty. I thought we were living in a Philip K. Dick universe, and we're living in a Rick and Morty universe. And the real question here in the presidential election is, like, how do we get to a different universe? Because this is not going to end well. But I do. Biden, the other thing that's interesting about Biden is that if you read more left-wing press, you will start to, I'm starting to see articles that are saying, you know what, Biden is a piece of crap because he is not signing on fully to the full kind of Black Lives Matter, Green New Deal. Like, he is a moderate. And it's, to me, what's going to be interesting, and I assume that Biden will win the November election, and I'm not happy about that. I'm not happy if Trump wins, but I actually think from a libertarian perspective, broadly speaking, it would be better to have Trump get a second term. But I'm very interested to see when the resurgent left starts to flex, and that's going to come sometime probably before the Democratic convention. They're going to start attacking Biden, and they're going to be helping Trump. And that is going to be a kind of fireworks show that I don't think we've seen recently.
Robbie, the resurgent left is mostly made up of young people like yourself.
Yeah.
And that's the big divide.
God, these kids.
That's the big divide in the Democratic
these
Party,
kids
right?
Kids who are waiting for their parents to pick them up at the bus stop because they have a slightly elevated fever. Robbie, tell us about yourself.
So, Robbie, tell us about that. And yet, I mean, like, I just sort of want your take on the relationship between the young left and Biden, because if you look at the polls just a couple of weeks ago, Biden was leading Trump with voters aged 18 to 34 by 19 points. Biden is leading in basically every age cohort, every demographic that matters. And even if young people aren't super inspired by him, they much prefer him to Trump. I mean, but why this guy in his 70s? Why this geriatric politician? Both of these guys exude a kind of ancientness and out of touchness. Biden is about the least online politician you can imagine. Why do the youngs prefer him to the other geriatric guy?
I mean, they don't. I don't think, well, they do to Trump. I don't think Biden inspires any particular warm feelings among young people. And not because he's old, but because he's not far to the left. He's a moderate. I mean, they liked Bernie Sanders quite a bit. That was the candidate of the young left.
The
and
other 70-year-old
fact,
guy who was the youth candidate. Yeah.
Right. So it wasn't about the candidate's age, it's about the candidate's ideas. It's certainly true, I think, that this is probably a hard time for the so young socialist left, because their guy lost big, kind of dramatic. It looked good for them for at least a hot minute there. And then it turned out that Biden won. And now he is, through kind of really no trying on his own part, he is doing really, really, really well. So by not going in the direction that the young left wanted, the Democratic Party is suddenly in a position to have this historic, massive victory. And, you know, probably things will get closer by the end. If it was held today, it would be a historic victory. Who knows what it's going to look like a couple months from now. I think mostly Trump's not running against Biden, really, right? He's running against the coronavirus. That is his opponent. And it's going to be a referendum on his kind of feeble response to it, his kind of rambling press conferences, all the things that turn people off of him.
Because Joe Biden is exceptionally sharp and just delivers like pinpoint razor sharp insights American government and public policy. He knows how to speak fast. He knows he gets his point across, right? He doesn't do what I do and just keep rambling on and saying the same thing.
Since
in
Nick mentioned Rick and Morty, there's this great Rick and Morty gag where Morty and Rick are just like they're yelling at each other, but then Summer, the daughter, will show up in the background and then they'll just start screaming at her instead. They're like, shut up, Summer, shut up. So that Morty is the American people, Rick is Trump, and Summer is Biden.
Okay, Catherine, we've now talked about how Joe Biden is running a non-campaign in which he proposes nothing, does nothing, says nothing, and wins. Except last week he did make a little bit of news when he said, like Nancy Pelosi did a couple of days later, that if he was president, he would implement a nationwide mandate on masks. Now, if you think that President Trump is running against the coronavirus, and that sounds in many ways right to me, then Joe Biden is going to, I guess, does that mean that Joe Biden is going to try to be the coronavirus? No. Then Joe Biden is going to want to wade into this issue. But what he has, his first sort of major policy proposal on this, the biggest thing he did certainly last week, was say, as president, I will require everyone to wear masks. Could the president even do that? Should he? How would that even work?
Right. So we've been applying this standard to Trump for a while now, which is that you must not only ask, should he do such a thing as he has said he would like to do, but can he do such a thing as he would like to do? Donald Trump generally has a very expansive and somewhat inaccurate view of the power of the executive. And so when he says things like, I'm going to reopen the entire economy by Easter, remember that? It is always worthwhile to examine that statement in light of the real powers of the presidency. Now, if a President Biden wanted to create the conditions for a national mask mandate, he probably could. It would be a work of the craft of politics. It would not be a thing he could just say from the Oval Office and then it would be true. But we could get ourselves into a situation where there's a national mask mandate. It would require coalition building and writing of legislation and cooperation. But the piece of this that really jumps out at me, and this is far from an original observation, but we are having a huge national moment right now about how over-criminalization and over-policing and uneven application of police force across a large population yields society-breaking results. We are having a huge fight about how if you, for instance, have a war on drugs going, but prosecute it in a way that it falls disproportionately on certain populations, you might have people marching in the streets in rage over how the police conduct themselves in enforcing those overbroad and unjust laws.
Yeah, the Democratic positions like defund the police except for the mask unit.
Except for we now need to have all the efforts of law enforcement in our country going toward forcing people to wear masks everywhere and always with
fair, they won't be enforcing, traffic safety laws anymore. So they're going to have a lot of time on their hands.
Cool. Right. So like this strikes me as a thing that is just so fundamentally at odds with something that we as a nation are finally coming to terms with, which is that some things cannot be done by force of law and should not be done by force of law. And a national mask mandate makes not a lick of sense. If you ask your Jerry Two Chilies about this, he's going to say, I am alone in the desert in Arizona. I see three people. Mostly I walk around and like bait rattlesnakes for fun. A national mask mandate makes no sense applied to me. This will be equally true for people who are living more conventional lives. But it's
wait,
shocking.
Are you suggesting that the rattlesnake baiting is unconventional?
I am.
Yeah,
I am going to stand by that claim.
Don't yuck his yum.
No.
You're
I certainly.
Him.
I did not yuck his
no
yum.
No kink shaming.
I would never. I would never. I love and respect
that from Robbie, not from you, Catherine.
I love and respect Jerry Two Chilies and would die for him, but I just don't spend a lot of time.
That's intense for a columnist.
Rattlesnakes.
Actually, I want to ask everybody generally about this, just sort of to go around the panel here. Scott Gottlieb, the former FDA commissioner, hater of vaping, who has also sometimes...
Darth Vapor.
Yeah, right. So has also sometimes been one of the better sources of information about the coronavirus. Had a Twitter thread in the last day or two calling for keeping kids safely in school, opening businesses safely, preserving life, basically trying to make it the next 6 or 12 months until there is a vaccine, pretty much saying we should do all of the things and that our goal should be to return to as normal a life as possible between now and when we get a vaccine. To do that, he said the chief thing we need is, quote, universal masking, though he did not explicitly call for a mandate. I just want to go around the group real quick. Can folks describe their personal mask usage or lack thereof? Any relevant details? Is there a good mask fashion shop that you've discovered, Robbie, that like you really like their patterns or something? I mean, they come in the right color. I will say I have an Etsy shop that I have bought like 5 masks from because they're cheap. They arrive quickly and they're actually super light and comfortable as masks go. I pretty much wear a mask whenever I am out of the house, except when I am exercising because it's already so damn hot here. And like trying to breathe while you're in a mask while you're running is not great. Nick, tell me about your mask usage or lack thereof.
Well, When I go out, I always wear a mask in public places. I'm in California now, where technically there is a mandate that you are supposed to wear a mask in public, regardless. In New York, it's
even
a little
outdoors.
Bit more forgiving. Yeah. It's a little more forgiving, where if you're in an enclosed space or near somebody, you're supposed to social distance and wear a mask if they can't get away from you. I wear mostly paper masks. I went to CVS and I spent about $30 on various types of cloth masks, none of which fit right. And one of them, I'm sure people will enjoy, was actually, it turned out to be a kid's mask that had like tie-dye on it. And it made my ears stick out even more than they do, which thankfully, because I can't get a fucking haircut, nobody can see anyway. But I'm respectful of businesses and establishments, and also like friends and social norms. I've been hanging out with people, and if they, you know, just as like when people ask you to take your shoes off when you visit their house, if they ask you to wear a mask, or if they say I'm more comfortable wearing a mask, that's good. You know, I'm happy to help people. I am also immunoprivileged because I do have antibodies for COVID. So I feel pretty good about all of this. But the main point, and I think this gets at what Catherine was talking about, is that I think I'm pretty representative, that like 99% of people like do what they think is best. Most people believe in wearing masks, especially around other people. Or when you enter a business that says no mask, no entry, I don't, you know, I think virtually everybody is doing that. And that's one of the reasons why a mask mandate is misguided, along with the fact that, when masks are, I don't know, masks are the law, only non-mask people will be outlawed or something. I don't even know where to go with this kind of, conniption that comes out of all of this stuff.
Robbie, are you dressing like Batman?
No, this will not surprise you. I have a couple custom masks that I ordered that are Legend of Zelda themed.
Oh, my God.
I have one that is the emblem of
Jinx
the...
Jinx from Pokemon? I'm betting that you have like an old Jinx Pokemon mask or something, Robbie.
That would be that's going into the blackface kind of discussion, because that's a problematic Pokemon. No, I have the Sheikah tribe from Zelda and also the Gerudo tribe, where there's one male member born every 100 years and he is their king. I won't get into the whole mythology of it, but it's a thing. So I wear
a mask. Was the
Yu-Gi-Oh
tournament canceled? Was the big Yu-Gi-Oh tournament canceled, Robbie?
we could have a whole different podcast on these subjects.
Let's
do that.
I do, as young person, whatever. But my video game habits, I think, do slot me into the young person category. At any rate, so I wear a mask when I go into the grocery store. If I were in a large gathering of people indoors and that was expected, I would do it. Kind of like Nick said, I want people to be comfortable. But I don't, when I just leave my house, no, I don't wear a mask. I covered some of the protests, so there were a lot of people packed together, and then, of course, I wore a mask. I think, I'm not at particular risk. I don't interact with virtually any elderly people. I live in an apartment building in D.C., which is a large apartment building that has almost entirely young people living in it. Now I'm going to visit some elder family members in Michigan next week. So my wife and I went and got tested, and we should get our results before we're there. So we should know, have that extra layer of comfort in knowing that we're probably not passing anything on. So that's kind of been my operating procedures. And I think, people just need to make like decisions for themselves based on what risk they have and what risk they present to others, and just like be kind of reasonable about it. And like Nick said, I think most people are doing that.
Catherine, what video game characters are on your masks?
None. I got stylish and elegant black masks as per reason dress code and my own aesthetic preferences. I wear masks when I go out. I have not made my children wear masks for the most part. I have not taken my children into any crowded places, but making small children wear masks is very challenging. And they are, my children at this point are at very low risk to be either spreaders or to be infected. I think that what Robbie said is about right, which is that you need to gauge what you're going to be out in. But you know what? I always have a mask with me. And I think in some ways that is a highly relevant thing that is undervalued. We are in many ways not actually enforcing mask wearing mandates. In many places, we are enforcing mask possessing mandates. When you look around, you see people demonstrating their desire to be good citizens and to be good friends and neighbors by having a mask. Everywhere, people have their masks pulled down, hanging off of one ear, poking out of a pocket, dangling from their rearview mirror. They are saying, when I look around me and I see someone who might be at risk or someone who I might be either at risk from or at risk to, you know, posing risk to, I am going to put on this mask. I am ready to protect my friends and neighbors, but wearing it all the time when I am in a sparsely populated area outdoors doesn't feel rational to most people, and it's not actually how they're using those masks. Now, we could be wrong. Our intuitions could be wrong about this. People are not great at intuitively understanding the spread of disease. That's why it took humanity so gosh darn long to figure out the germ theory of disease. It's hard to figure out. It is not something that our brains are wired to do. So I am open to the possibility that people are screwing this up and that they are screwing it up systematically and routinely in dangerous ways. The place that I just keep coming back to is I still don't think Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden saying, okay, now federally everyone has to wear a mask always is actually going to dramatically alter people's behavior. And if it does, it won't necessarily do so in a way that comes without huge costs. So anyway, personally, I take a mask with me everywhere I go. I wear it when I'm anywhere near people, but I am to some extent doing it as politeness and citizenship theater. When I am walking in a street and someone is far from me and we don't represent a risk to each other, I put my mask on or turn my head anyway because I am a nice freaking person, darn it. And I think most people are nice freaking people, darn it, and we are trying our best and that our best might not be good enough, but Joe Biden saying your best should be better isn't going to make it better.
Do you agree with the gendering of mask wearing? Is it true that real men wear masks?
Yeah, that, by the way, my God. Like speaking
what, are we going
of
back
the gap,
to the great quiche debate of the 1980s?
Yeah. Well, no, speaking of the gap between the actual current Democratic Party and the woke left, like, real men wear masks is a sentence that could cause a
but not
riot
all real
on
men
most college
have
campuses
penises.
At this point.
You know, this is like, but real men don't have penises either. So it gets very confusing very quickly.
Well, that's the incoherence of the, you know, not to go to my favorite favorite subject,
just,
but
like,
the incoherence of the intersectional
push the play
left.
Button on Robbie. Yeah.
It's both, you know, there's, you know, masculinity and femininity are a construct. There's no differences between men and women. This is all socially constructed and made up. At the same time, men are evil. Masculinity is evil, et cetera, et cetera. So it's both made up, but also ironclad for the purposes of denigrating whoever the social justice left.
Yeah, but
like.
Then again,
sorry,
Nancy Pelosi, I mean, forget about, you know, Trump and Biden. Nancy Pelosi, I think, was in like, didn't she work as a personal assistant to Grover Cleveland or something? So, you know, it's just, I mean, the ancientness of the gerontocracy that is running this country is becoming a real problem.
They
won't die. What else can happen that these people are not leaving the stage?
I will say Nancy Pelosi has some of the best mask fashion of
so
any public figure that
love
I have seen.
It.
Like I just, it's honestly, it's really great and kind of impressive. I think the, I am reasonably convinced that masks are actually important for limiting social spread. On the other hand, there's just so much social signaling. As you said, Catherine, my favorite example of this is that the corner tavern near my house that I walk by just about every day has a big outside seating area that has been open for the last several weeks. But of course, DC rules are that you have to have a mask to go into a restaurant. So you have to put, even if you're sitting outside, then you can take your mask off once you're at the table. So people go up to the edge of the patio wearing a mask and then get moved 10 feet down the patio to sit on a table and take their masks off. And then everybody's there with their masks off the entire time. And it's just this like weird thing where you sort of have to present as I have put a mask over my face to walk up to the podium to get seated. And it's just it doesn't really make any sense at all, especially if you're walking. Yeah.
It's the 3-ounce bottles at the TSA. It's absolutely a thing that has an origin in something real that has become a both a theatrical way of demonstrating that you are a good person and a good citizen, but also a way for legally liable entities to enforce something so that they won't get their right to their livelihood taken away.
Yeah, so
you know, that's actually, not to, you know, open up a vast new, you know, cemetery here. The question about liability is really hanging over a lot of this and hanging over the opening, the reopening of the economy and whatnot. And I think we have not started as a society, much less as a podcast, to really kind of even engage that, because it is going to be absolutely, I mean, whatever we've been dealing with now, when you throw in every possible claim, every possible counterclaim, et cetera, it's just going to, I mean, this is, you know, I don't know. I'm 56, 57, like it matters. And the rest of my life is going to be spent out, you know, dealing or watching ads about liability, going back to Peter, your corner bars opening policy in 2020. It's a nightmare.
I think we're going to find that tested. Let's actually move on, since Catherine brought up 3-ounce bottles, to the question of what you're consuming. Robbie, let's start with you. What video game are you playing? What are you watching? What?
So this weekend, I convinced my wife to watch a Chinese martial arts war epic with me. And she was very...
Wait, did you
very,
get a bootleg copy of Mulan?
Is Mulan problematic yet?
Casting of that movie and sort of the development of it and trying to figure out how to make
It's all Uyghurs
that it
now,
would be...
right? Didn't they replace everybody with Uyghurs? So it's like
right,
it's all set.
Right. Or they didn't cast a trans person. Anyway, I watched...
Robbie.
I watched Red Cliff, which is a fantastic movie, a historical drama about the actual historical battle in 208 AD at the Red Cliffs, which ensured the division of China into three kingdoms for centuries. The interesting thing is there's a famous historical novel, The Romance of the Three Kingdoms, that was published hundreds of years later. That's one of like the most famous novels in Chinese literature, and I'm a big fan of it. It's like Game of Thrones times a million. There's like 10,000 characters in it. Many of them like die of shame or something. That's the way a lot of bureaucrats in Chinese government die. But the novel is a revisionist propaganda because the person writing it was in favor of one of the three kingdoms. And so there's all this actual like magic, like it's 70% real history and 30% like their kingdom uses magic to subdue these other kingdoms. That's not true. So the film is actually very historically accurate. And so unlike the historical novel, does not include magic and sort of correctly portrays the kingdoms and their given sizes and strengths and does not have this like one of the main characters killing the other by changing the direction of the winds. So it's a fun, entertaining example of the movie being more accurate than the famous historical novel upon which it is based.
Nick, what are you reading or watching?
I watched Netflix, the new Will Ferrell movie, Eurovision Song Contest, the Fire Saga. The story of Fire Saga. And when I was thinking, it's good if you like Will Ferrell, it takes place in Iceland mostly and then Europe. And as I was watching it, I was starting to wonder whether or not Will Ferrell is actually a member of the Boogaloo Boys. Because in a country that
explain
is...
Explain to us what the Boogaloo Boys are.
They are a white alt-right, white supremacist, loose confederation of troublemakers who show up at Black Lives Matter protests and cause problems. But so in a nation that is, you know, roiling with racial stress and, you know, trying to deal with a difficult past and whatnot, Will Ferrell somehow evacuates all of that to go to Iceland, the whitest country in the world, and then end up in at the Eurovision competition, where the darkest competitor is a woman who is representing Greece. It is a very funny, it is a very good movie. It is a classic Will Ferrell kind of story. If you like things like Blades of Glory or Old School, you will enjoy this movie quite a bit. And it's what else is good about it? on a certain level is the Eurovision Song Contest, which is an annual contest where different countries promote one one act or one singer, one performer or band to represent their country in a kind of World Cup or a European Cup final contest. That is becoming more and more popular in the United States. And it is a very funny, interesting, kitschy, and yet weirdly unifying kind of contest. If you go back and watch, you can find all of these old footage. ABBA was a regular winner of this type of stuff way back in the day in the 70s. And it's a wonderful kind of regional but international event. This movie is very funny, and it hits many of the funny notes that have just gone missing from America for at least the past 200 years.
It seems like a close cousin of the genre of movie that I know Catherine is a fan of, the movie in which all conflicts are eventually resolved via dance-offs. Catherine, yes. Does the Eurovision comedy appeal to you, and or what are you watching?
100% appeals to me, and I will probably consume it. As I have said before, I really enjoy any type of film where the tension resolves around whether or not we're going to get to regionals. That's basically where I'm at a lot of times, and this sounds
you
like
will, this movie is made for you, and it is child friendly while Great. Also being adult satisfactory.
My recommendation is a six-part series with the sixth part not yet out. It is called The Murderbot Diaries by Martha Wells. And it's just a really, really delightful. The first four are novellas. They're short. You zip right through them. The fifth is a full-length novel. I have not read it yet. But it's basically... It's a genre I'm actually hoping that we're going to see more and more of because, and this is a little bit to Robbie's joking point earlier, if it turns out that no one is allowed to write human characters anymore that are in any way divergent from them demographically, right? We're not allowed to write a character of another race. We're not allowed to write a character of another gender. Gender is also not real, but it's also the most real thing. Race is not real. It's the most real thing. The way out of this is going to be science fiction, and in particular, post-humans of various kinds. And the main character in this series is a droid, I guess. It's an android, or just a droid.
And so what would you say the difference is?
We probably don't need to go too deep on this, but it is basically a largely fabricated entity that has some cloned material from, we assume, human in it. It has organic parts that have human quirks, but is also mostly an artificial intelligence and robot body that hacks its own governor, becomes Ooh. Independent and slightly more sentient than its colleagues, and then has adventures. It's great, you guys. Just really a pleasure to read.
And is it trying to make regionals? In taking over?
No, this is definitely more my other preferred genre, which is just the journey with difficult to ascertain goals or endpoints. But I think that we're actually going to see, my hope is that we will see a kind of fluorescence of science fiction, especially of the kind of post-human variety, because that will be the only thing that is safe to write anymore. And I, for one, look forward to that future.
I have been playing...
Sorry, I should say this was a recommendation from Ron Bailey, so credit where it is due.
Okay.
Thank you, Ron Bailey. I have been
Ron
playing...
Ron Bailey, who is also struggling to supersede his central processing unit.
So true.
I mean, I just imagine that Ron Bailey is literally always reading post-singularity fiction about people who have transcended being people. The way that I have chosen to do that myself is to play video games, which allow you to inhabit another character. I've been playing one for the last week, The Last of Us Part 2. It is the sequel to the 2013 post-apocalyptic game The Last of Us, which was a production of Naughty Dog Studios. That game, the original, was one of the best written games I have ever played. Just in terms of video games, are like, even some of the best video games are often not all that well written, not all that well scripted. They don't pay that much attention to sort of to character work. And one of the things that distinguishes the Naughty Dog games is that they are really about story and character as much as they are about action and geography and exploration. That is even more true in The Last of Us Part Two, which is yet again just one of the best written, sort of most smartly told stories that I have encountered in months, if not years, in any medium. And what's really amazing is that some of the best sequences are not action sequences. They're not the big sort of video game fighting bits, although those work very well and are extremely intense at times. But instead, there's this flashback in which a little girl who has lived in basically a post-viral zombie world for most of her life and has been in a safe community. So she's gone to school. She learned about America. She learned about how men once went to the moon, you know, that sort of thing. But has never really experienced kind of normal living as we think of it. And she is taken to a museum that has been overgrown. And it turns out to have dinosaur skeletons and then a whole sequence, a whole section in the museum on space flight. And she gets to get into the cockpit of like one of the, you know, the tops to the rockets that, you know, we went to space in. And the guy who has taken her there, who is sort of her surrogate father character, gives her a little recording on a tape player of the sound of a recording from inside the cockpit of one of these rockets actually lifting off. And you just sort of see her imagine another world and imagine escaping this one. And this isn't a video game. It's this incredible little character moment about what it's like to live this very difficult post-apocalyptic life after a virus has killed almost everyone and sort of infected the world with zombies. And it's really fascinating to see that sort of thing happen in a video game. And it's smart. It's transforming. I recommend it for anybody who just sort of likes well-written, engaging media of any kind. And with that, I will let you all go for the day. Thank you all, as always, for joining us. This has been the Reason Roundtable. We will be back next Monday with Matt Welch once again.